Well, this evening we're going to begin a new series of sermons. We have finished our studies in Malachi, and we're going to do some studies in the book of Psalms. We're going to look, God willing, at the Psalms 120 to 134. And the reason that I want to take these psalms is that they form a group of small psalms within the book of Psalms. Indeed, it seems that they were collected into a separate collection at one stage in the history of Israel, and they were used in as pilgrim songs. Now, you'll notice that each of these psalms, the 15 psalms of this group, as we indicated on Sunday night when we were mentioning about songs, each of them is a song. In our version, our English, our King James version here, they are entitled Song of Degrees. And there are different ways one could translate that: Song of Ascents or Song of Steps, some would translate it. But each of these psalms is in fact not so much a psalm as a song. And so what we have here is this book of songs. And they are recognized as pilgrim songs. And there are different ways in which these psalms have been interpreted, and the significance of the pilgrim theme that we find in these psalms, of course, is emphasized over and over again. And when we see them described as songs of degrees or songs of ascents or songs of steps, there are various reasons given by different scholars as to why it is that these psalms are described in this particular way. And basically, there are four different interpretations given as to why they are called songs of degrees or songs of steps. The first interpretation is not a very popular one. It is the idea that these 15 psalms are called songs of degrees or steps because of the literary composition within them, and that there are those scholars who find that there are stages of increasing exaltation within the psalms. As I say, that is an interpretation that is not the most popular way of understanding why these songs are, in fact, described as they are in the Psalter. The second interpretation as to why they are so designated is that these 15 psalms literally represent the 15 steps that were found between the court of the women and the court of the men in the temple. And as there are these 15 psalms, so as the worshippers went up into the court of the men, each psalm represented one of the 15 steps. Now, that is a rather fanciful interpretation, but nonetheless, there are a number of scholars who hold to that particular view, and it may well be a pure coincidence that the 15 steps, in fact, and the 15 psalms just happen to coincide in that particular way. A third interpretation, which is more to the point, is that these psalms represent the various steps of the people of Israel in their pilgrimage wanderings, especially in their exile and in their return from the exile in Babylon. And you may recall in Psalm 137 how they could not sing the Lord's song in by the waters of Babylon, and their mockers were asking them to sing songs of Zion, and they could not sing the Lord's song in a foreign land. But as they began to come back from the exile, so we are told, they began to sing once again the Lord's song. And that these songs of degrees that we have in these Psalms 120 to 134, in fact, represent the kind of sentiments that the people of God were experiencing as they returned from their wilderness exile and back to the Lord's temple once again. Now, there are serious criticisms, of course, against that particular view, but nonetheless, it's quite a popular understanding as to why these psalms are described as they are. The fourth and perhaps the best interpretation is that they are pilgrim songs, and they do represent the pilgrims going up to the temple, but not so much in terms of their return from the exile, but those three times in the year. You may remember how, according to Deuteronomy chapter 16 at verse 16, all the males in the nation of Israel had to go up three times in the year to the temple or to the central place of worship to worship the Lord. And they had to go there to worship at the three great feasts of Israel, the Feast of the Passover, the Feast of Pentecost, you remember, and also the Feast of Tabernacles. And if the people of Israel, or the men in Israel particularly, did not attend these feasts, then the penalty was very severe. They were to be cut off from among the people of Israel. In other words, they were no longer to be regarded as belonging to the community people of God. And so they would go up on pilgrimage to give thanks to the Lord for what he had done, represented his goodness, represented by these feasts of Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. And that probably is more to the point as to the significance of these particular psalms. And it's interesting that as we look through the psalms, and we're going to look at Psalm 120 this evening, we find that that there is a progression not only up to the temple, but there's also a spiritual progression as well. This Psalm 120, we find at the end, the psalmist is still living in a strange land. He lives among the people of Mesech and Kedar, and we'll see what that means just in a moment. But then when we come to the last of these psalms, Psalm 134, we find that there is the worshipping of the people of God in the temple. And whether this refers to the priests in the temple or whether it means the congregation gathering in the temple, the point is that this psalm, this group of psalms begins with the psalmist in a strange land, and he's feeling very out of place where he is, and the psalms close with the temple, the people are in the temple, and the Lord is blessing them out of Zion. So it's not only pilgrimage in the sense of a physical movement from afar off into the temple of the Lord, it's also spiritual movement, as there is maturity and development and growth throughout these psalms, as we shall see. So they're well-named pilgrim psalms because they deal with literal pilgrimage. They also deal with the spiritual pilgrimage of God's people. Now, as we look at these 15 psalms, we find that four of them are attributed to David. We find that Psalm 122, for example, is a song of degrees of David. And if, in fact, this psalm was composed by David, then it could not be a psalm that was composed at the time of the Babylonian exile, because the Babylonian exile, as you know, took place more than 500 years after the death of David. And then Psalm 124 is also attributed to David, as is Psalm 131, and also Psalm 133. And in these psalms, we find that Psalm 127 is said to be a psalm of or for Solomon. And again, this psalm must have been written long before the time of the Babylonian exile. So it could be that these psalms are the most recent of all the psalms, or some of them at least are the most recent psalms in the book of Psalms. But some of them, it seems, were written long before the time of the Babylonian exile. So they were collected together, it seems, and they were used as a corpus of songs for the tribes of Israel as they made their way to the temple or to worship on these great feasts. So that's basically what these psalms are all about. And there is this similarity that binds them together as a separate group within the book of Psalms. And God willing, that's what we're going to be looking at over the next number of weeks and months. Well, we come then to the first of these songs of ascents, Psalm 120. And this psalm is, of course, a cry of distress. You often find that, I've emphasized this before, that but a very good way to understand the subject of a psalm, sometimes psalms are difficult to understand, sometimes psalms deal with more than one thing. But a good way to understand the psalms, individual psalms, is to look at the first verse, because often you find the first verse sets the theme and the tone, and it's a kind of a superscription which gives the subject matter that is to follow in the psalm. For example, Psalm number 23, "The Lord is my shepherd," is the opening statement. And we find that the rest of that psalm, Psalm 23, is simply an exposition and an outline of the consequences of what it means to have the Lord as our shepherd. So it's that kind of thing that we find in the psalms. And so that's why I say that this particular psalm here is a cry of distress, because that's how it begins. And right throughout the psalm, the psalmist really is giving us reasons why it is that he is, in fact, crying unto the Lord. And interestingly, just whilst we're on this theme of trying to understand the Psalms individually, even the whole book of Psalms is best understood in the light of Psalm 1, where the psalmist there in the first psalm, you may remember, he makes that clear line of demarcation between the righteous and the wicked. Blessed is the man, you may remember, who does not walk in the way of the wicked. He meditates upon God's law day and night. The wicked are not so. And you remember how the psalmist speaks of the righteous standing in the congregation of the righteous and the congregation of the Lord, and the wicked are going to be cast away like chaff. And that psalm, of course, deals individually with the distinction that the Bible makes between those who are acceptable to God and those who are unacceptable to God. But nonetheless, throughout the psalms, we find this same theme over and over again. The fool says in his heart that there is no God. And there are many of the psalms which deal with the ways of the wicked and the final outcome, the wages of sin, which is death. And on the other hand, many of the psalms, most of the psalms, in fact, deal with the spiritual life of those who belong to God's community people, and how they are going to live their life of faith and faithfulness in the world. And at the end, when all is over and done with, they're going to go into the house of the Lord forever. And so this is how we're to understand the psalms. Well, this Psalm 120, then, is the first of these songs of ascent, songs of degrees, the pilgrim songs. And it's a psalm of a rather a plaintive note. The psalmist says, "In my distress I cried unto the Lord, and he heard me. Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. What shall be given unto thee, or what shall be done unto thee, thou false tongue? Sharp arrows of the mighty with coals of juniper. Woe is me that I sojourn in Meshech, and I dwell in the tents of Kedar. My soul hath long dwelt with him that hateth peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war." And this psalm covers quite a lot of ground. In a sense, it seems to be dealing with different things, but really it's dealing with one main theme. The psalmist is in a foreign country. He is amongst a hostile people. The environment is not congenial to him. And he recognizes that he is in the midst of enemies, and his only hope and recourse is to call upon the name of the Lord. And we find that this is what the psalmists do over and over again. And in fact, throughout the Bible, we find this invitation. Psalm 50, "Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me." Now, this psalm itself sets the scene in verse 1. The psalmist in verse 1 speaks of something that took place in the past. He uses two perfects. In my distress, I cried. He's speaking of something that he did in the past. And he is speaking of how the Lord heard him in the past. Now, there are some scholars who take the view that verses 2 to 4 really are an explanation of what the psalmist was praying for in the past. But I think a better way to understand it is that the psalmist, because he understands that in calling upon God in the past, and God has heard him in the past, he has every reason, therefore, to call upon God in the present. because every other verb in this psalm from verse 2 onwards, in fact, is in the present. So verse 1 refers to something in the past, and verses 2 to 7 refer to his present experience. And this is what we find in the Bible. Over and over again, we are reminded as Christians to remember what God has done in the past. And we are exhorted to remember the past because God does not change. And if he heard his people in the past and blessed and delivered them in the past, then the scriptures assure us that he is going to do the same in the future. And this is why we have to look at the scriptures and read how God dealt with his people then, all these thousands of years ago. And we are to do so remembering that God is the same today and Christ is the same today, yesterday, today, and forever. And so therefore we too can call upon the name of the Lord as they did in their generation. That precisely is what the psalmist is doing here. Now, he is praying for deliverance in the present experiences that he's finding himself in from verse 2 through to 4. And it seems that he is in the midst of people who are criticizing him, and indeed they are misrepresenting him. Deliver me, deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. Now, it's no new thing for God's people to be criticized, condemned, and misrepresented in the world. We're reminded in the Epistle to the Hebrews, for example, that we're to remember Jesus Christ, who endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. And the word there for contradiction is a word which means people were actually speaking against him. And when we read the Gospels, we find over and over again how Christ was continually criticized and contradicted. And the scribes and the Pharisees, the Herodians and the Sadducees, you may remember they were continually coming to him and tempting him, seeking to trip him up in his speech and find fault with him. And they were condemning and criticizing what he was teaching. And it's going to be the same down through every single generation. Christian people have got to face the fact that we are not going to be the most popular people in our community. We can live the most godly lives. We can become the most honest people and the most reliable in our community. But that is not going to stop the lying lips and the deceitful tongue. People are going to misunderstand our motives. They are going to misrepresent us. And as soon as we fail or have a fall or a fault of any kind, there is going to be immediately an outburst of condemnation and criticism. And so there is nothing new in the world misrepresenting and contradicting our Christian professing, and perhaps accusing us of hypocrisy and such like things. And preachers of the gospel have got to face the fact that because we are the public face and we are the public spokesman for the gospel, we of all people are going to be criticized. And so there's going to be nothing new in the fact that God's people in the world are going to be spoken against. The prophets were. Jeremiah was told to shut up, and twice he was put into prison in order to silence him. And he was accused of things that were untrue. And so was our Lord Jesus Christ. They accused him of being filled with Beelzebub and being a representative of the devil, and one who was seeking to upset and demolish the law of Moses, and one who was seeking, in fact, to cause divisions and upset amongst the people. He deceives the people. Why do you listen to him? They were saying, concerning our Lord Jesus Christ. So the psalmist here is experiencing something similar, and he is asking the Lord to deliver him. He himself is not going to retaliate in kind. He is not going to speak about the world or about the people who are criticizing him in the way that they are speaking about him. He is simply going to commit his case unto the Lord. But he is also conscious in verses 3 and 4, he is also conscious of what the outcome is going to be for those who habitually and continually will criticize him and misrepresent him. What shall be given unto thee? Or what shall be done unto thee, thou false tongue? What is the fruit? What is going to happen to those who continually speak against the people of God in this world? Well, the psalmist tells us in verse 4, sharp arrows of the mighty, sharp arrows of a warrior. There's going to be a judgment, he says. And the judgment is going to come in the form of sharp arrows and coals of juniper. And this is just a biblical way of speaking of the judgment of God. Because the people of God, we have to leave a vengeance unto the Lord. There comes a time when we've simply got to keep our mouths quiet and take it and cop it, because there is nothing else required of us to do. In our Christian living, there comes a time to turn the other cheek. But God is going to deal with those who will criticize and condemn his people. And we've got to leave the judgment unto the Lord. There are times in the church, for example, when of course we have to speak against evil. And we have to retaliate. The very first sentence in the very first Christian sermon that was ever preached was an explanation that those men who were laughing or mocking those early Christians in the book of Acts chapter 2. These men are full of new wine. And they were mocking them and saying these Christians are drunk. And you remember Peter said they're not drunk. So Peter, the very first thing he said was to disabuse misunderstanding and misrepresentation. And there comes a time, of course, when we have to stand up and defend our cause as Christians and speak up against the criticisms of the world. But there comes a point where we can go no further and we simply have to leave the matter with God. And that's the way it is. And it's not an easy thing to do because God's judgments seem to be delayed. And the wicked seem to go on in their criticisms and in their lying, deceitful tongues against the Christian faith. And I don't need to multiply examples over and over again in the media and in the world. We find it all the time. Christianity is abused, it is criticized, and it is condemned. And it is continually under the criticism and condemnation of an unbelieving world. And we simply have to leave the matter with God. He is the one who will bring sharp arrows and the coals of juniper, coals of judgment, upon those who are deceitful and lying in their condemnation and criticism and rejection of the ways of God's people in the world. So that's what the psalmist is speaking about in these verses 1 to 4. But then from verse number 5, there is a kind of more personal application. Woe is me, he says, that I sojourn in Meshech, that I dwell in the tents of Kedar. My soul hath long dwelt with him that hateth peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. Now, we mustn't misunderstand the psalmist here. When he says, woe is me, this is not a man who is filled with self-pity. Sometimes we can fall into a mood where we feel rather sorry for ourselves when we're serving the Lord, and all we seem to get for our trouble is misunderstanding and criticism and on suffering. And sometimes it seems that not serving the Lord would be a much easier thing to do. And we begin to feel rather sorry for ourselves. And why is it that we are suffering? And why is it that we are continually, as the psalmist puts it, you remember Psalm 70, why is it that he is chastened every morning? And the people of the world seem to be just enjoying life. They're standing out with fat, and everything that their hand touches seems to turn to gold, and everything that we try to do seems to be coming to pieces, and nothing seems to work. And we can begin to feel very full of self-pity and such like things. Now, that is not what the psalmist is doing. The psalmist here is recognizing that there is a spiritual issue. And there's a spiritual principle that he is concerned with. And he's not so much concerned with the fact that he is feeling sorry for himself. He is concerned with the fact that he is not, at this particular juncture of his life, living amongst the people of God. He says, woe is me that I sojourn in Meshech, and that I dwell in the tents of Kedar. In other words, he is not in Jerusalem, he is not in Zion. Now, we don't know exactly where the psalmist is. And when he says here that he was living in Meshech and Kedar, this obviously is symbolic language for the simple reason that Meshech and Kedar were very distant places, one from the other. The people of Meshech lived, as far as we know, somewhere around the southern shores of the Black Sea, what is the present Black Sea. And the people of Kedar, they lived in the Syrian desert. And these places are far apart. And it's evident that the psalmist couldn't be living in these two places at once. So what does he mean when he says here that he lives in Meshech and he lives in Kedar. Well, he doesn't mean it literally. He means it symbolically. He is living amongst people who are like the people who live in Meshach. And he is living amongst people who live like the people that live in Kedar. Now, you might say, well, that's a rather fanciful exegesis, is it not? Not at all. The Bible uses this kind of symbolism over and over again. Let me give you some examples. Take, for instance, the book of Revelation, chapter 11. At verse number 8 of that chapter, we are told of the church. The two witnesses, they are being put to death, you remember, and their bodies were put into the streets of that great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where their Lord was crucified. Now, the fact of the matter is that the Lord Jesus Christ was not crucified in Sodom. Sodom didn't even exist at the time that Christ came upon the earth. And the fact is, he was not crucified in Egypt. He was crucified in Israel. He was crucified outside the walls of Jerusalem. So what does the book of Revelation mean when it says that Christ was crucified in Sodom and he was crucified in Egypt? Well, what is the significance of Sodom? It was the ungodly place. It was the place where sins ascended up to heaven. It was the place that God was determined to visit in destruction and in a fiery judgment. Their sins were, as it were, crying out for judgment. And it is the idea that Jerusalem had become like Sodom. And what is the significance of Egypt in Revelation chapter 11? Well, Egypt was the nation that oppressed the people of God. It was the place that in which they were in bondage. It was the place that would keep them in bondage. It was the place where, after they had their deliverance, the Egyptian army came after them and was going to bring them back captives again, or else, in fact, destroy them. So the symbolism of Sodom is the symbolism of extreme sinfulness. And the sinfulness of the symbolism of Egypt is the symbolism of a place that is oppressive and persecuting to the people of God. And it's the same kind of thing that we have here. The people of Meshach, and the people of Kedar, they were heathens, they were pagans, they were vile. It seems that they were both warlike tribes, forever delighting in bloodshed. And here is a man, he wants to live at peace. All he wants to do is to worship his God and serve him, and he cannot do it because these people simply will not leave him alone. That's what the psalmist is saying. It's a spiritual issue that he is concerned with. He cannot worship God as he would in such a hostile environment. We have the same kind of biblical symbolism, for example, in the way that the Bible uses the word Babylon. Think of Babylon again in the book of Revelation, chapter 16, 17, and especially in chapter 18. In the 18th chapter in the book of Revelation, we are told there of the destruction of Babylon. Now, Babylon literally is not being destroyed in the book of Revelation, chapter 18. It is this world that's being destroyed. Why? Because this world is Babylon. Babylon is the place where men get together, combine their ingenuity, where they gather together, and their whole interest and ambition is to live without God. And that is what the Bible, that is what the book of Revelation means when it uses Babylon as a symbol for this present world. You and I tonight, as Christians, we are living in Babylon. The city of Sydney is Babylon. Every single city in the world today is Babylon. The whole world today is Babylon. We are surrounded by Babylon. Babylon is the city of man. It is the city where men will be their own gods, invent their own religions, and where men will build their own towers that reach up to heaven. And if there is going to be any exploration of the universe, if there is going to be any reaching up to heaven, it won't be because God comes down to us. It will be because, as we know from the original Tower of Babel, Babylon, it will be that we will reach up to heaven, and nothing is going to be impossible to us. That is what is meant by Babylon. And that Babylon is going to be destroyed. Our world is going to be destroyed. And that is what is being revealed to us in Revelation chapter 18. The whole of this man-made civilization, where the whole interest is in trading and money making and such like things. It is all going to be brought to nothing at the last. That is what it's all about. And that's the symbolism. Now, there are other places in the Bible where we have this kind of language used. The ancient nations who were oppressing the people of Israel are used as symbols of present oppressions. And that's what this psalmist means when he says he was living in Meshach. He wasn't literally there, either in Meshach or Kedar. He may well have been in Babylon, for all we know. We don't know. The point is, he is saying that he is amongst people who are not friendly towards his religion, and who do not like the way that he lives, and they do not like the way that he speaks. Because he says, my peace, my soul hath long dwelt with him that hateth peace. I want to live in peace, but they do not want to live in peace with me. I'm for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. Now, if this psalmist is a man after God's own heart, which we think that he probably is, and we will assert that he probably is speaking to these people about God. He is no doubt explaining to them why it is that he is worshipping the God of Israel, whose name is Jehovah, and they don't want to hear it. When he speaks to them, no doubt, words of peace, not words of antagonism, but words of peace. They want to go to war with him. And this is the picture that we have in this psalm. And the psalm closes with the psalmist still living, as it were, in the midst of a dispeace and discontent. He is almost at the end of his tether. He says, my soul hath long dwelt with him that hateth peace. In other words, I can hardly put up with this for very much longer. Now, you see, when we look at it like that, how up to date all this is. For the simple reason, this is a pilgrim. He is speaking of his lonely life in a hostile environment. And is it not interesting and most instructive that when we come to New Testament scriptures, we find that God's people are described as pilgrims and strangers upon the earth? We have been reminded by Christ Jesus. Marvel not, he says, if the world hates you. Rather, he says, remember it hated me before it hated you. If we think, as many people are trying to preach in churches today, and they are greatly mistaken, I put to you, that if we live the Christian life, the world is going to fall in love with us and fall in love with our God, we are greatly mistaken. There was a time in the history of our world when there was a man named Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and he lived a life without sin. He lived amongst the most privileged people on earth. They had every opportunity. They knew the scriptures. They saw his life. And even when they came to accuse him and condemn him, they had to bring false witnesses who had to bear false witness against him. He challenged his accusers. Which of you is going to accuse me of sin? There was no fault in him. They knew that he spoke the truth. They knew that there was no guile in his lips. They knew that he had never violated any commandment. And yet their final verdict was upon him was, take him away and crucify him, because we do not want this man to reign over us. We don't like that kind of people in our world. And let us be very clear, that is the way it is. All who will live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. And if you and I want to evade persecution, then just don't say anything for God, don't do anything for God, and the world will approve, the world will shake our hand, and the world will smile, and the world will think that we belong to them. The moment we, like the psalmist, begin to open our mouth and begin to stand up, we are going to become targets. And we are going to experience not the smile, but the frown. And we're not going to experience the compliments and the commendations of the world. We are going to experience the criticisms and condemnation of the world. And so here is the psalmist. We don't know what his future was. We're not told. We don't know whether this was David or not. It may have been. We don't know. The fact is, the psalm ends with the psalmist in the midst of his enemies, but he has prayed to the Lord. He knows that God is watching over him. And he knows that God is going to deal with those who would indeed be at war with him. And this is a pilgrim psalm. And you and I, as we go through these psalms, will find the movement towards the ultimate glory when we stand in the presence of the Lord. But in the meantime, there is a pilgrimage. We have to face the fact that we too live in Meshech and in Kedar. And when we are at peace, there are many who simply will not be at peace with us. They will be at war with us. And we are pilgrims and strangers upon the earth. And as McLaren in his commentary on this psalm says, he says, those who experience what the psalmist here is experiencing, he says, these are the people who desire a better country. And that is really the heart of our Christian pilgrimage, because we are, as it were, strangers upon the earth. But, like the patriarchs of old, we seek a better country. We seek a city, a heavenly city. And we seek that city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And we are going to dwell in that city, in that house that Jesus speaks about in John chapter 40. I go away to prepare a place for you. And when I go away, I will come back again. And I will take you to be with me, so that where I am, there you shall be also. That is what the Christian life is all about. That is our hope. That is our destiny. But in the meantime, we just have to pray to God. And in the meantime, we have to just face the fact that we are living the pilgrim life. And let us therefore live it with the pilgrim spirit and with the destiny of the glory before us, the glory that is going to be revealed. That's what these psalms are all about. And that's why this psalm, as it were, sets the scene of a pilgrim in a hostile environment. But nonetheless, he is not without hope, because he has prayed to the Lord, and he knows that God hears and is the answerer of his prayers. And that's the kind of thing that we need to keep in mind as Christians. Well, that's Psalm 120, and as I say, we'll look through these psalms, God willing, and see what they have to tell us about the Christian life and the Christian hope. But we'll have to leave it there, because time has gone. Well, may the Lord bless his word to us.